is Frater Ralph with Temple of the Infinite. And I'd like to start off by saying Happy Rosh Hashanah. This is the Jewish New Year. I believe in some parts of the world it's already come and gone, and here I think it starts at sundown tonight. Forget now what year it is, 57-something-something. But, you know, Happy Jewish New Year, and here at Temple of the Infinite, we have had a busy weekend. Oh, I got into networking a little bit yesterday with a friend of mine, and we hit on what turned into a rather extensive project, which still really getting my hands on, and just doing a lot of good networking, linking up with some good organizations that share our vision here at Temple of the Infinite Universe about interfaith understanding, awakening of consciousness, harmony, you know, all that stuff. And when I first hit on the idea of doing Temple of the Infinite Universe as an interfaith outreach, building on love, compassion, and openness and understanding towards all, I thought we were doing something radically new. And here I look around and I'm finding a lot of other good people that are just tuned in, focusing on that same wavelength, that same energy of love. And, you know, it's good to find. It's wonderful because, you know, I thought that doing this we'd be inventing the wheel ourselves. And here I'm finding out, you know, a lot of other good people have invented this wheel, you know, a lot sooner than what we have, so we don't have to go back and reinvent it at all. We just have to kind of team up, network with these other organizations, these other folks, and just help one another get this message of love and unity and oneness out. And there's a lot of good people out there. You know, the late Wayne Dyer was one of them. And there's several other folks out there. And there's a lot of living people still out there, too, just networking and working quietly. Quietly, behind the scenes, working towards an awakening of human consciousness where we can eventually, as a race, as a human race, tap into this higher frequency of love and understanding. So it's been a wonderful weekend. You know, it's been busy forming alliances, forming bonds. And this morning I learned how to, on a somewhat different note, I learned how to make memes. I always liked memes when I'd find them on the internet. I'd find them on Facebook and Twitter, and I'd share the memes that I liked and always thought, you know, wouldn't it be neat if I could learn to make our own memes? And so I sat down and found a couple computer apps, one of which works perfectly, and started experimenting with making our own little memes that we will use on the internet, on Facebook and Twitter, and even thought, you know, it's time to update the program art for this program here, Temple of the Infinite, and go out there and take a few good snapshots, a few good pictures, digital pictures, and put them through the mem maker and create some good program art for this channel. So, you know, a lot of good things to do, a lot of fun and very worthwhile things to do. But right now we're about talking about how Buddha became a Catholic saint. And this is a story that I heard as a undergraduate taking a course in World Religions, I think, was the title. Anyway, that was the focus, World Religions, and studied about intra-religious dialogue. And I had a teacher that was a really neat guy, Mr. O'Hara. And back in those days, he was a guy who started out as a Benedictine monk and studied, of course, Catholicism, studied Eastern religions, Asian religions, and then after a while decided he no longer wanted to be a monk. He met a nice woman and wanted to get married. So he got married and went from being Brother O'Hara to Mr. O'Hara. But the man was a very open, loving, mild-mannered genius. And he told us, being familiar with Buddhism and Hinduism and Catholicism, a story that really tickled him and thought it would tickle us, his students in the class, told us the story of Saint Josaphat. And Josaphat was the story of a saint. Actually, he was, that was the name given to this saint. But what happened is that sometime in the late Middle Ages, travelers came back from the East, and they brought with them stories of this great saintly man who was the son of a ruler. And this ruler ruled a mighty kingdom. And a sage prophesied once that the son of this great ruler would become a sage, would forsake his kingdom and his kingly duties, and just become a great saintly man. And as the story went, this ruler, the father of this would-be saint, did not want that for his son. He didn't want a religious saint in his household. He wanted a ruler who would take over his kingdom and rule the kingdom when he was gone. And so he did everything in his power to keep his son, and the name here given to him is Josaphat. The father did everything in his power to keep Josaphat from living a life of religious fulfillment and religious study. So he carefully shielded his son from any kind of esoteric studies. But as the story goes, the son happened along this another man who helped him in discovering, you know, the spiritual life. And as time went by, Josaphat decided to forsake his princely duties. He forsook his kingdom. He forsook all the riches and the splendor that he had in his palace back home and went out into the wilderness, became a monk, practiced spirituality, grew in wisdom and saintliness, and just taught the gospel, as the story went, to anybody who wanted to listen. And when this story came in from the East, back into the area of Rome, back in the late Middle Ages, people clamored for the Pope of that time to take this Josaphat and make him a saint. You know, give us a saint that they wanted, because, I mean, the saintliness of this man, according to the story, was great. Folks of that time probably thought that this was like the Eastern version of St. Francis of Assisi. Francis was a very loved saint in that time period, and folks were saying, you know, Josaphat, let's make him a saint too. So the Pope and the church authority of that time went ahead, and they canonized this man that was known as Josaphat, and they knew he came from somewhere in the East. But other than that, and the story surrounding him, not much was known about Josaphat other than that story. Now, let's fast forward up into the 1950s, about 700 years from the canonization of St. Josaphat, and a bunch of Jesuits, great, knowledgeable people, great scholars, real left hemisphere kind of people, bastions of orthodoxy, they got looking at the canon of saints or the list of saints. And it was their job at that point in time to kind of clean up the record. They knew that some folks had slipped into the canon of saints or the list of saints over the centuries. that probably, according to their thinking anyway, didn't belong in the canon of saints of the Roman Catholic Church. And they began to do some digging into the backgrounds of these saints. And one of them was, you know, Saint Christopher. And they looked at the historical background of Saint Christopher and found that they couldn't find one. They more or less concluded that Saint Christopher was a story, a myth, got circulating sometime in the distant past. They couldn't find any proof that he actually lived as a human being. So they recommended that he be taken out of the canon of saints. And Saint Christopher definitely was a very popular saint in the 1950s and remains one to this day, even though he's no longer officially a saint. And they started looking at Josaphat, too. And they began to look at that name, Josaphat. And they began to look at that story. And they thought, now, this story of Saint Josaphat, the son of a great ruler, whose father wanted him to be a kingly ruler and not a saintly hermit or religious figure, and a great man who forsook his kingdom, forsook his riches, lived a life of simplicity and poverty, fled into the wilderness. They began to put two and two together, and they thought, this sounds very much like the story of the Buddha. And then they started looking at the name, Saint Josaphat. And they started digging into their linguistic database, and they found that if you take the Pali term of Bodhisattva, you know, great savior, I forget exactly now what it literally means, but it means a person who would work tirelessly for the enlightenment of all, a person who would live a life of self-sacrifice. Bodhisattva is a term that is applied to the Buddha among other people. And they started looking at that word, Bodhisattva, and they found that if you take it from the Pali and you transcribe it into the Arabic, and then from Arabic you transcribe that to Greek, and then from the Greek you transcribe that to the Latin, it seems that Bodhisattva eventually becomes corrupted into the name Josaphat or Josaphat. And these very smart Jesuits put two and two together, came up with four, and said Josaphat is none other than Gautama Buddha. And we've been adoring him, honoring him as a saint for about 700 years. And Your Holiness the Pope, we don't think this is proper, so we move that Josaphat be stricken from the canon of saints. And so he was. But now, is it really proper that not only did Saint Christopher lose his wings, so to speak, back in that time period, so too that Saint Josaphat was stripped of his sainthood, in the Roman Catholic Church anyway, for the, and I'm going to be kind of facetious about this now, but just for the petty reason that he wasn't even Catholic, wasn't even Christian. But I mean, let's look at the teachings of Buddha and compare them to the teachings of Jesus. And while I am not going to sit here and say that they are absolutely identical, you know, there are differences. But there are numerous similarities between the teachings of these two great figures. And I am going to go on the record right now as saying that from my perspective, the philosophy of Buddhism makes a wonderful complementary asset to anyone's practice of spirituality. You know, be that spirituality, Christianity, Judaism, New Age, whatever. Buddhism is a philosophy that goes well with most any other religious worldview out there, including atheism. In its strictest sense, I think Buddhism is recognized as being more of the atheist mindset than the theist mindset. But, you know, you don't have to be atheist, theist, or even Buddhist to practice the Buddhist philosophy. I'm going to take a break right now, and when I come back, I'm going to get into a comparison of the teachings of Buddha and Jesus. Teachings of Jesus here taken predominantly from the Sermon on the Mount.
I like those songs.
Alright, this is Fred or Ralph back, and in this segment I will be comparing, rather loosely, admittedly, the teachings of Buddha and the teachings of Jesus. And the teachings of Jesus I am pulling out of the Sermon on the Mount and the Gospel according to Matthew, for the most part. And the teachings of Buddha, my source material there, will be found a wonderful book by Thich Nhat Hanh called Living Buddha, Living Christ, which I stumbled across, probably about 6-7 years ago. And it is a fantastic read. Thich Nhat Hanh is a very good writer. It's not a heavy-duty technical type book. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh himself is a poet as well as a Zen master. So he has a writing style that's pretty easy to comprehend. He does a very good job of explaining the Buddhist terms to a Western audience. And he just does a very good job. This is a small little paperback book that I have. And you can sit down, you can get through it, even if you're a slow reader like I am, within about a week. And it's a good source of material. My other source of material is coming from the Theravada Buddhist tradition, and that is the teachings of Ajahn Brahm of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. And he's got a book out called Open the Door of Your Heart, kind of a collection of the wits and wisdom that he contains and has been teaching for the last several years. And his organization is very generous about providing his teachings all across the internet. Just Google Ajahn Brahm or the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, and you will come up with YouTube video after YouTube video of one-hour Dharma talks that he provides. And his perspective is even easier to understand than Master Hanh. Ajahn Brahm comes from Great Britain, and he knows a Western mindset. He's lived it. He studied as a forest monk in Thailand and then went to Australia, formed his own monastery, and a very engaging speaker. I mean, he's got topics on his YouTube channel like, does life really suck? I mean, that's not the title of a Dharma talk that you would expect from a Buddhist monk. But, I mean, he puts it in the common language. Does life really suck? Or reincarnation, here we go again. he approaches it with a good sense of humor and in terms that anybody can pretty much understand. So those are the materials that I recommend for anybody that wants to get into an understanding of Buddhism. Unless, of course, you're already Buddhist, and well, then you might still want to check them out because, I mean, they are, it's good stuff. But the first point I would like to raise, comparing the teachings of Buddha to the teachings of Jesus, is that Buddha taught unconditional love, and so did Jesus. In the Buddhist doctrine, the Buddhist mindset, it's called metta. And metta can be translated as unconditional compassion. It's like the compassion that you feel for another living being just because that living being is there. And it's the kind of compassion you can have for your children, your spouse, your next-door neighbor, even an ant that you almost stepped on the sidewalk. And the teaching of unconditional love is that this is a fruit that we must work to cultivate, that every living being, you know, be they animal, mineral, vegetable, human, every living being deserves our respect and our compassion. And a large part of the Buddhist teaching is how we develop sense of compassion, how we grow as compassionate people. Now, in the first century, and if you're a Greek student, not necessarily a Greek scholar, but a Greek student, you will be aware that Jesus taught agape. And in the Greek, agape means unconditional, unmerited love. Now, if you're a scholar, I'm sure you can find some differences between compassion and love. Myself, I don't see a great deal of difference. You know, Jesus taught love for all, hatred towards none. You have compassion, you have love for your fellows, be they fellow Jews, fellow Christians. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, Jesus tells the story of a Samaritan who loved a Jewish man so much that he did everything he could to make sure that this Jewish man was safe. And the rub to this story is that when Jesus was telling this story of the Good Samaritan, Jews and Samaritans were bitter enemies. They did not mix. They did not get along. And yet Jesus uses as an example of love this story of how a Samaritan man does everything he can to assure the survival of a Jewish stranger that he finds beaten up by the side of the road and left for dead. And we can kind of reflect on today's sad history between the Jews and the Muslims of the Middle East and the sad happenings that are currently still, after what, 70-some years, still happening in that neck of the woods because of the hatred between Jews and Muslims and Jews. Not everybody. There are exceptions. There are those that have the higher frequency, the higher vibration of love. But, I mean, what we see in the press is just the opposite. You know, the other side of the story. If it bleeds, it leads, is the way our news goes. But you know, there is the love there. We just have to work on strengthening it and overcoming the hatred and transforming the fear into love. But Jesus, too, taught unconditional love. For Jesus, it was agape, the unearned, unmerited, unconditional love of God for all of creation, a love that we are called to participate in, to share, to be bearers of. And Buddha taught metta, unconditional compassion, the kind of compassion that you give to any creature, human or non-human, however great, however small, just because that creature is. Because it is. Because it shares in being, just like you share in being. Now, we are all brothers and sisters in being. We share a similar, or you might say the same, beingness, because it comes from the divine source. And so we're all brothers and sisters, children of a common source, whether we're human, non-human, alien, extraterrestrial, insect, whatever. Even minerals are to be loved and given compassion. So definitely a parallel there between these two great teachers. Second point I like to raise is meditation. You know, Buddhists are very well known for their practice of meditation. And you got so many different forms of meditation. You got mindfulness meditation, sitting meditation, walking meditation, metta meditation, you know, meditation that helps us to focus on cultivating that unconditional compassion. And many more forms of meditation besides. Buddhists are very big on that practice. You might say, like Ajahn Brahm has said, that when asked which text that he would recommend to the beginning student of Buddhism, you know, he said he used to recommend the Pali Canon or certain books out of the Pali Canon. But in later life, he said that if you wanted to study the quintessential text of Buddhism, it would be the book of meditation. Just sit down on your mat, meditate flat out for an hour or two a day, and you will begin to understand Buddhism. So that's how closely interwoven the practice of meditation is into the practice of Buddhism. You know, according to Ajahn Brahm, they are practically one and the same. Now, did Jesus teach meditation? And here some Christians will probably say, well, I don't think so. But now if we look at Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 6, from the Sermon on the Mount, that section in the Gospel of Matthew, and listen to the teachings of Jesus, I think we will begin to understand that Jesus actually did teach a form of meditation. Here Jesus says, when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners, so that they may be seen by others. Truly I tell you, they have received their reward. Now, if you're going to pray, don't go out on the street corner and make a big show of it. You know, that's not prayer, according to Jesus. That's theater in the park. But no, Jesus says, when you pray, go into your room and shut the door and pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you. So Jesus is saying, and I mean, this takes a little bit of understanding to kind of flesh it out. But when you pray, go into your room where it is quiet and shut the door. Some translations will say go into your closet, you know, a much smaller confined room. Close the door where it is nice and quiet and no one can see you. And also, the practice of meditation, more importantly, no one can disturb you. And pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you openly. And, you know, admittedly, I might be reading something into this, but, you know, in other gospel accounts, you know, we have accounts of Jesus rising early in the morning, before the sun is up, going off to a quiet place to pray. And his disciples, they sleep in till sunrise. They're not as mystical. They're not as dedicated to the path. So they sleep in till sunrise, and they wonder, where's Jesus? And they go out, and they find him, and he's off in the wilderness, just sitting on a rock. And it doesn't take a whole lot to kind of tie up the loose ends and reach the conclusion that when Jesus is talking about prayer, sometimes he is talking about praying in standard words, but keeping those words short and sweet and to the point. And then there are other times when Jesus spends hours in prayer, just in silence, out in the wilderness. And you might ask the question, okay, if you're praying using very few words, yet at the same time you're spending hours out in the wilderness, all by your lonesome, you're not really praying formal standard written prayers. You are doing what we today would call meditation. Just a very careful listening to the divine voice and to the world around you, and just focusing in to the world of spirit and seeing, hearing what the world of spirit has to say to you, and gaining whatever insights you are given, and then taking these insights out into the world around you. And I believe very strongly that, you know, Jesus did practice meditation, and it was his practice of meditation that gave him the energy and the strength to perform the miraculous things that he did and the quality of ministry that he had. So meditation, another parallel we can draw between the teachings of Buddha and the teachings of Jesus. Another parallel is forgiveness. Jesus was a great teacher of forgiveness. We have the prodigal son that, now this isn't in the Gospel of Matthew, this is the Gospel of Luke, but a very familiar story for almost every Christian, I would think, without exception, although there might be a few out there. But the story of a son that dishonors his father, basically says, "Dad, I wish you were dead, but since you don't have the decency to die, I want my inheritance right now." And the father gives the son the money, and he goes off and squanders it on reckless living. And then when the money is all gone, the son decides he's going to come back, apologize to the father, and not just a lame, "I'm sorry," kind of an apology, but a very deep, heartfelt apology, saying, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm not worthy to be called your son. Just take me in as your slave and feed me something other than this hog slop that these other people have been feeding me for taking care of the pigs." And for a young Jewish boy in the first century, you know, being out of money, dirt poor, broke, working on a hog farm, that was as low as you could get. And, of course, the father will hear nothing of it. The father forgives the prodigal son, welcomes him back into the family, gives him the family crest, the family ring, which in ancient days would have been the same as the family credit card, and says, "Come celebrate. My son was dead, but now he is alive again. He was lost, but now he is found." In Buddhism, we have a similar story. Actually, many different similar stories. The one I'm going to relate here is a Zen parable. It talks about a student by the name of Oshiri, I believe. And the story goes like this. Oshiri, a student of Zen Buddhism, is sitting in his home, meditating quietly, and a robber comes in to his home. He puts a knife to the back of Oshiri, and he says, "Give me your money." And Oshiri, without flinching, simply sits there, meditates, and says quietly, "I keep the money in a jar over on the table." And the robber looks up, sees the jar on the table, walks over, finds the money in the jar, takes the money out, and begins to leave the room. Oshiri calls out to the robber and says, "They will be coming tomorrow to collect taxes. Leave me a little money so I will be able to pay them." And so the robber turns away from the door, goes back to the jar, puts some money back in the jar, and then once again turns to leave the house. Oshiri calls out to the robber again, and he says simply, "Don't you usually thank somebody when they make you a gift?" And so the robber says thank you to Oshiri, takes the money, and runs. Now, over time, this robber robs many other people, and the police catch up with him. And they figure out that this guy has been robbing a great many people. And they also figure out from the robber's confession that he also robbed the student, Oshiri. So the police go to Oshiri and they say, "Hey, we captured this guy. Did he rob you?" Oshiri, again, doesn't flinch. He says simply, "No. The man came to me. He asked for money. I gave him some. He thanked me. And that was it. As far as I'm concerned, it was a gift. He didn't rob me." And so anyway, the police leave, and they take him to court. And amongst the robber's many other crimes, they do find people who are willing to testify against him. And he goes to prison for a few years. But upon his release, the robber remembers the kindness, the forgiveness of Oshiri. And he returns to Oshiri and says, "Will you please accept me as your disciple?" Story of reconciliation, story of forgiveness that I think would even do Jesus proud. And so both teachers, I will say enlightened masters, taught the same or similar doctrine of forgiveness, unconditional love combined with unconditional forgiveness. Now, Jesus on the cross, again, out of the Gospel of Luke, not Matthew this time, but out of Luke, you know, hanging on the cross saying, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." Even after being nailed to the cross, Jesus is still forgiving those who saw to it that he would be crucified. Radical kind of forgiveness that is hard for the average person to practice, but it is the same kind of radical forgiveness and reconciliation that was taught by the Buddha and also by Jesus. I am going to take another break, play a song, and I will be back with a few other points. All right, another common teaching between the Buddha and Jesus, the understanding that one would be it would be necessary for one to sacrifice oneself for others, the idea of self-sacrifice. In Buddhism, this is known as the Bodhisattva, and the Bodhisattva is a certain type of a Buddhist who is a great soul who wants to help other people so badly that he himself or she herself will put off enlightenment just for the sake of remaining here on earth so that they can help other people grow spiritually. The idea of the Bodhisattva is that I wish that everybody else attains enlightenment, even a blade of grass, before I do, because I want to help in this process of bringing other people to enlightenment and helping other people to gain and to progress spiritually. And enlightenment can be seen as something similar to the Christian idea of salvation. Usually, when Christians think of salvation, you know, the way I was raised, it's like you're saving your soul from hell. But really, there's a lot more to the idea of salvation than just saving your soul from hell. If you look at the scholastic idea of hell, hell was understood as separation from God, and salvation was understood as union with God. And union with God, or the divine source, is pretty much how one might also understand enlightenment. It's becoming one, seeing the oneness, feeling the oneness, becoming the one, and just being one with the entire universe and the power behind the entire universe, and being freed from the cycle of birth and death and rebirth, and just remaining in the heavenly spiritual realms at one with all creation. And I think Christians can see this and understand this, or theists can also understand this as union with God, as you understand God. So this idea of self-sacrifice, the Bodhisattva would, you know, help other people to attain salvation in any way that he or she could. And we can compare that to the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. Here Jesus was, I believe anyway, trying to make a point to his disciples. He spent 3, 4 years, perhaps more, working with them, teaching them through words what unconditional agape love was like. And then somewhere along the line, Jesus understood his words weren't really getting through to his thick-headed disciples. And I believe anyway that that's where Jesus hit upon the idea that I'm going to show them not through my words, but through my actions. And he marches into Jerusalem, makes a big show of himself, goes into the temple, kicks out the money changers, almost incites a riot, and gets himself arrested and handed over and crucified. And I know there are other ways that this is traditionally interpreted in Christian thought and Catholic thought, but I'm sharing with you my views that, you know, Jesus didn't have to die on the cross. He chose to die on the cross so that he could demonstrate unconditional love to his disciples and also to deepen his own unconditional love within himself, knowing that when a great teacher or even a not-so-great teacher makes a sacrifice on that level for the right reasons and gains a deep spiritual understanding attains a great spiritual gift, that gift not only is given to the person who attains it, also given to their closest disciples and to their followers and to the rest of the human race. And that is an understanding of the Bodhisattva. I think we can also apply that to the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross, where he says, "This is the blood which will be shed for you and for many, so that sins can be forgiven, so that this negative karma that you are laboring under can be lifted, and so that you can attain this spiritual gift and advance more rapidly upon the spiritual path, and just avail yourself to the grace of God without all this heavy karma laying around your neck." And so self-sacrifice for others, the idea of the Bodhisattva, the idea of Jesus and his sacrifice on the cross, I think we can see some connections there. Buddha also taught poverty, renunciation of worldly things. His followers begged for food. They generally had some sort of shelter, a communal shelter that the monks would all gather together and live in. Others that were forest monks and hermits, they might live inside of a hollowed tree or a lean-to out in the wilderness. But they went out into the surrounding community and they would beg for whatever they needed. A bowl of rice, maybe rags for clothing. And when the Buddhist monks lived together in common, you know, in a monastery, they would share all things that they had in common. The idea of private property didn't really resonate with the early followers of Buddha. Teachings of Jesus run along a similar line. You know, Jesus would say to people that would come and say, "Can I be your follower?" He would say, "Okay, sell all that you have, give the money to the poor, and then come and follow me." You know, give everything away when you have nothing, when you have renounced all your worldly possessions, then we can sit down and talk spirituality. And in the book of Acts, you know, we see this too as a standard practice of the early church, that they would sell all that they had. They would bring the money to the apostles, lay the money at the feet of the apostles and say, "Here it is, this is everything I have." They would then use that money to look after the needs of the community of believers, wherever that community happened to be. If it was the church in Jerusalem or the church in Antioch or where, you know, wherever it was, you know, that was the practice of the earliest church, was to hold all things in common. Again, the idea of private property did not resonate with the earliest followers of Jesus. Now, in later Christianity, we became pretty good capitalists. And, yeah, private property was definitely something that you could have. Nowadays, it's encouraged. If you give 10% to the church, you're doing pretty darn good. Some folks will give even less than that. But in the earliest days, it wasn't 5% or 10% or 15%. It was everything. And they held everything in common and just focused on building up the community of faith, the community of practice. In Buddhism, we have the understanding of nonviolence. In Buddhism, I believe it's known as ahimsa. I know that's how Gandhi described it. Of course, Gandhi was not Buddhist, but I think Buddha taught in similar language. The idea of ahimsa, or do no harm. You know, something that Wiccan and pagan practitioners can relate to. Do no harm sounds pretty much like it's right out of the Wiccan read. But yeah, do no harm, do no evil, overcome evil with good. In early Christianity, drawing from the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus teaches a very similar doctrine. Love your enemies. Do good to those who persecute you. Do not overcome evil with evil, but always overcome evil with good. And Paul also echoes this in some of his teachings. You know, overcome evil with good. And do no harm to an evildoer. Something, again, that was pretty well practiced in the early days of Christianity and the early days of Buddhism. And unfortunately, it's a practice that we've gotten away from. We've definitely gotten away from it in the practice of contemporary Christianity. And we have also, I think, gotten away from it in the practice, some practices of Buddhism. You know, the propensity towards violence is something that has really overtaken us in this modern age, and we call it progress. Well, I won't go that far, but you know, it's definitely something that has overtaken us, and it's time to get back to the original spirit and the original teachings of our founders, our founders of our faiths, whatever that may be. And so, yeah, Buddha taught nonviolence, perhaps not strict pacifism, but what I would definitely call a qualified pacifism. You would still be allowed to defend yourself against someone who is trying to kill you or members of your community, but you were not allowed to kill recklessly. Now, first you would be, the teaching would be, first try to restrain your attacker, then maim your attacker if you can't restrain him, and then if you can't restrain, you cannot maim, you cannot stop the attacker, then and only then is it okay to resort to deadly force. But it was not something that you rushed into lightly. It was only an absolute last resort. And in Buddhism, I don't know what they call that. In Christianity, we call it the just war theory. And that's another thing we've gotten away from. You know, many different depths of teaching of the just war theory, like slaughtering mass numbers in warfare is against the just war theory. Killing of civilians and non-combatants is forbidden in the just war theory. And I can't really think of a modern contemporary war that really qualifies as a just war. Our politicians say they are just, but according to the strict teachings of the church, and by that I mean the Catholic Church, the last several wars we have fought in the 20th century and the 21st century have not been just wars. I think the last one, well, even World War II doesn't really qualify, because there we've had, you know, the killing of non-combatants on large scales and slaughter and warfare. So, again, nonviolence, qualified pacifism, do no harm, love your enemies, do good to those who persecute you. Overcome evil with good. Another point of similarity here. Present moment awareness. Be in the now. In contemporary Buddhist teachings, I know, who is it? Ram Dass wrote a book called Be Here Now. And you know, just the idea of present moment awareness. Don't worry about the future. Just be in the present moment. Take care of first things first. And, yeah, just don't worry about tomorrow. In the teachings of Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, towards the end of the sermon, Jesus says, you know, don't worry about what am I to eat, what am I to wear. You know, what clothing am I supposed to have? What do I use for money? And he says, just be in the present moment. Have no thoughts or worry for tomorrow. Let today's own worries be good enough for today. You know, don't waste your time worrying about what might happen tomorrow. Just spend your time in the here and now, taking care of the things you need to take care of right now. So, present moment awareness. We see it clearly in the teachings of the Buddha, and we can also draw that out of the Sermon on the Mount. Have no worry, no anxieties for tomorrow. Be here now. And the last point I'd like to raise here is spiritual powers in the teachings of the Buddha. Spiritual powers are to be developed, but they are not to be used carelessly. And in stories of Buddhism, we hear about monks that through very deep practice of meditation found that they had the ability to levitate. They could meditate, and then they could levitate. And there's a story about a certain ruler that takes a wooden bowl, a fine wooden bowl, very nicely crafted wooden bowl that any Buddhist monk would love to have for, you know, going out and, you know, begging for alms and going into the village and begging for food. You know, they had their alms bowls, and this was a nice, you know, hand-carved wooden bowl that was just exquisite detail. And the story goes that the ruler puts it on top of a very high pole with no ropes around, no ladders, and he issues a challenge to the Buddhist monks. He says, I've heard you guys can levitate while you meditate. So what I want you to do is levitate, and the first monk that can levitate high enough to reach that wooden bowl on top of this tall, tall pole, you know, your prize is you get to keep that wooden bowl. And the Buddha, in his teachings, taught against that. He said, okay, you live simplicity. You don't use your powers in flashy ways. You may develop psychic powers, but you are not to use them for personal gain. And as the story goes, this is told by Ajahn Brahm, this one monk was able to meditate and levitate to the point where he got himself up high enough where he could grab the bowl, and then not only did he grab the bowl, but he did a little victory lap in midair around the pole, kind of showing off to everybody, hey, I got the bowl, I got the bowl, look at me, I've got great powers here. And then he finished his meditation and his levitation, descended back to the ground, and went into the monastery to show off his wooden begging bowl and say, hey, isn't this great, look what I got here. And as the story goes, the Buddha came in, and he sees the wooden bowl that the monk has, and he doesn't have to be told. He knows the challenge that was set out by the ruler, and he knows how the monk got his hands on the bowl. So he chews them out. He says, look, your spiritual powers are to be used for the good of the community, you know, for love, you know, not for personal gain. And here you basically prostituted yourself for a wooden begging bowl. And he takes the wooden begging bowl, he rips it to shreds, he gnashes it up, tears it apart, throws it onto the ground, and just tells his followers, look, we are supposed to be something different. We're not supposed to be doing that, so no more of this. In the teachings of Jesus, spiritual powers are to be developed and used for the common good. And again, this is something that we've lost sight of in contemporary mainstream Christianity. You know, Jesus tells his followers, go out, heal the sick, raise the dead. He demonstrates his ability to manifest the multiplication of the fish and the loaves. In some gospel stories, this happens once. In other gospel stories, Jesus repeats it a couple of times. And he tells his followers, this is something that I can do, and this is something you should be able to do too. In the Gospel of John, he tells his followers quite clearly, these things and greater shall you do. For I am going back to the Father, I will send you the Holy Spirit to give you power to do these things. So cultivate these powers, develop these powers, but use them wisely. Use them for the common good. Don't go out there and do theater in the park or theater in the church, you know, walking on water in the baptismal font or healing people just for a show, you know. Get out of your wheelchair. Throw away your crutches. You know, there are actual manifestations of divine healing power, both within Buddhism and within Christianity. Unfortunately, the attention seekers, the attention grabbers, and the charlatans are usually what we see on the front page of the newspaper when scandal breaks out. And the good, quiet people that do these things quietly and try to keep themselves below the radar, you know, they get ignored. But there are good people out there who are doing these things. And Jesus, I think, clearly teaches, develop spiritual powers. Paul, in the book of Corinthians, I forget exactly where, says, seek out the spiritual gifts. Sincerely seek out the spiritual gifts. Desire the greater gifts. Then he goes on and he says, and the greatest gift of all is the gift of love. And in Corinthians chapter 13, he goes into a great, beautiful poem about love being the highest of the spiritual gifts. But, I mean, Paul also talks about, you know, teaching, inspired teaching, prophecy, healing, several other spiritual gifts that are out there. And he says, develop these, sincerely seek after them, but earnestly desire the higher gifts. And for all, you know, by all means, use them wisely. So those are 8 points of similarity that I managed to pin just early this morning, comparing the teachings of the Buddha with the teachings of Jesus. I'm going to take another break, play a little song, and then we'll go ahead and wrap this up. Thank you. right, now there's my comparison I just did over the last, 45 minutes, of the similarities as I see them between the teachings of Buddha and the teachings of Jesus. And I think with all that laid out, and I think there are many different points of similarity we could find, but with just those laid out, I think we can begin to see how the people of the late Middle Ages might hear the story of a great Buddhist teacher, understand it, you know, through a Christian mindset, through a Christian lens, through the Roman Catholic tradition, and be going to the Pope and be saying, hey, we need to make this guy a saint. And as best we know, his name is Josaphat. So, yeah, give us a saint. Canonize Saint Josaphat and a few other folks here, too. And I forget now the friend of Josaphat that was also canonized at the same time. But as it later turned out, this Josaphat was none other than the Buddha. But I think when we look at the teachings of Buddha, teachings of Jesus, their lifestyle, you know, I think that Thich Nhat Hanh is dead right when he says that Jesus and Buddha would be brothers, that their teachings were very much in harmony with one another. And I think that if Buddha were alive today in the flesh, and if Jesus were alive today in the flesh, and they happened to be in Rome, and they got together with the Pope, and just got together, they would definitely do lunch. And I think they would definitely discuss theology, but they would definitely discuss spirituality. And I think in the course of maybe 1 or 2 hours, Buddha, the Pope, and Jesus would find much common ground. Now, perhaps not perfect common ground, but enough common ground where I think we can see that certain practices of the Buddhist tradition are definitely complementary towards anyone's practice of Christianity or spirituality, whatever name you give to that practice. And again, just a lot of common ground that we see here. I'm going to wrap this broadcast up. I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to be talking about Tuesday. I had promised going into spiritual healing, energy healing, supernatural healing. I am prepared to give a little bit of a talk on the tapping method. I would like to get a guest on air to talk about Reiki. And I'm not sure if I can line my guest I have in mind up by Tuesday or not. This might not take place until Thursday, but Reiki, I mispronounced it, Reiki. I'll definitely get into that at some point in the near future. And next Tuesday I will get into a little topic of energy healing or spiritual healing and get us started on that. But until then, now, in your own spiritual practice, I think that we can get all riled up on theology and terms and terminology, but the deepest part of anybody's spiritual practice should be the cultivation of love, of compassion, of forgiveness, of reconciliation. And if you look at the world around us, because I'm remembering that story I read just this morning of the attacks in Israel, you know, the Dome of the Rock, not the Dome of the Rock itself, but a mosque by the Dome of the Rock, Arabs pointing the fingers at Jews pointing the fingers at Arabs. And just one side against another, each side thinking that they have legitimate grievances against the other. And so they do. But when it comes to these conflicts, wars, nations, and religions rising up against one another, there are no angels here. We all have our legitimate grievances where we can see, hey, you did this to me, and I don't like it, and I will not stand for this. And we can use that as justification to go out and wage war or commit atrocities. And other groups, other religions, other nationalities can point the finger of blame right back at us and say, this is what you did to us. This is what you're doing to us. These are the atrocities. And we can dig up dirt on one another. But the true work of being a true human being, the hard work, is to say, yes, did those atrocities. We have committed grievances. We have been the victim of grievances ourselves. But we have to rise above all that. At some point in time, we have to transcend the hurt and the pain and the grievances and the atrocities, and let go of that lower vibration of fear and hatred and anger. Tune in the higher frequency of love. Find forgiveness. Find work towards reconciliation. Work towards true justice. Not justice that is rooted in revenge and vigilantism, but justice that comes from the heart of the divine. Justice that is based in mercy. Justice that is rooted in compassion and love. Love for ourselves. Love for one another. A love that finally lets us open our eyes to see that we are not separate. That I am the other. Me and my enemy are one. We have met the enemy, and he is us. That's what our mission here at Temple of the Infinite Universe is really all about. Trying to find common ground, trying to come to a deeper understanding of our differences and our commonalities, and to work at laying the old bitterness, which in some cases go back centuries, taking that old bitterness and laying it aside, saying, I am not going to be a barbarian today. I am going to work today at being a true human being and resonate from that higher frequency of love. If you'd like to learn more about Temple of the Infinite Universe, our mission, our services, I encourage you to go to our website at www.hermetictemple.com. And until Tuesday, this is Frater Ralph signing off, wishing you a blessed evening of spiritual discovery. Remember, focus on love, cultivate love, be the love. It's not easy, but in the end, it's what separates the true human being from the animal. Blessings.